This is The End User, episode 153 for Thursday, November 28th. That's Thanksgiving Day. Ethernet Poltergeist. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
And Taylor, we dropped a couple weeks there. I have since moved apartments and gotten sick. And a lot has happened since we've been podcasting last.
A lot has happened. A lot of new stuff come out, a lot of new features. I'm really excited to talk about it. I'm so glad that you're feeling better. I'm glad that we're back. I'm really excited.
Yeah, so shall we get right into it? Well, what do we got going on?
So the big news for November, basically, is that the new Microsoft Xbox One came out and the Sony PlayStation 4 came out pretty much at the same time.
Yeah, they really timed that perfectly, didn't they?
They did, probably for the 2013 holiday season.
Yeah, so from what I can see in the press, and again, I don't have one. I know Josh Pollard and Richard over there at Entertainment 2.0 talked a lot about the Xbox Ones that they actually have now and have been experimenting with. But the sense I get from kind of a meta perspective of the technology news industry here is that it's been kind of quiet for the PS4.
I think it's been kind of quiet for both of them. It's sort of a slow adoption. There are hardly any games that you can only get on either of these platforms. Pretty much all the big games that are being sold right now are still available for either the Xbox 360 or the PlayStation 3.
Yeah, and I guess the launch titles have been a little disappointing. They're not as big as they have been in the past. But, I guess there's Forza for the Xbox, which is a pretty big launch title. But it's the gaming front of it has been a little quiet, and a lot of the games are actually just launching later.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a slow rollout for these games. But we can definitely talk about the hardware and the interface. I feel like we've been talking about it for months already, but we've learned a lot more now that people actually have their hands on it. And I have seen a big improvement in the hardware for both of these devices. But I think the PlayStation comes out on ahead. It's a much better designed system. But where Microsoft always excels is the software. And they have an amazing platform, which, as we've mentioned before, lets you control your whole media center using the Kinect voice availability.
And apparently that's a little bit disappointing in places. There are some things that work pretty well, but some of the ways in which you control the Xbox are just using your voice to control a menu, which is kind of pointless. But, you know, it's early days. I'm willing to give them that. It's still early, and even if that stuff isn't 100% right quite yet, I'm sure they will kind of fix it over time as we go here. I mean, this is a 10-year play, don't forget.
Yeah, which is amazing for me to think about. But I agree. I think the voice control software is going to come along. And definitely one thing that I've noticed about the Xbox 360 versus the PlayStation 3 is that the Xbox software has matured over the life of the console in a much bigger way than the PS3 has. I use the PS3 several times a week now because it's one of the hubs of my current media center, and I'm constantly struck by the clunkiness of the interface and how dated it looks. It feels futuristic, but it doesn't actually work in a futuristic or intuitive way.
Yeah, and I think that is the dichotomy between the Xbox One and the PS4 is one of them has much better software, it would seem to me, for stuff that is not gaming. And one of them is really focused on gaming and has the hardware to back it up. So depending on what kind of person you are, one might be better. But
the problem is that hardly anyone needs either of those things at the level they're being offered.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I feel like the Xbox One is kind of this mass market play, and the PS4 is a hardcore gamer play. And it's very similar in a way to what was happening with the Xbox 360 and the PS3 in the first place. But I feel like it's been amplified in this round a little.
It definitely has been amplified. I mean, all of the tendencies that they had in the last platform, we're seeing redoubled in this platform. One area in which they've both made huge improvements is the repairability of the hardware. So iFixit has already gotten their hands on both the Xbox One and the PS4, taken them apart and given them a user repairability score of 8 out of 10. Each of them got 8 out of 10. Now, for the Xbox One, you don't need very many tools to take it apart. It's got a modular design. It's a bigger console, so everything fits together easier. You can get in, take things out. But the hard drive is difficult to access, and you'll void the warranty if you want to replace it. On the flip side, the PlayStation 4 has a standard hard drive that's very easy to access and replace. You can put in whichever drive you like. And I believe this was true of the PS3 versus the Xbox 360 as well. But the PlayStation 4, it has security screws and basically everything, every other part of the PS4 is difficult to take apart without voiding your warranty.
Yeah, and well, if you're taking your console apart, you are probably voiding your warranty.
Yeah, but you should be able to take it apart to a certain extent, like, for example, replacing the hard drive. So yeah, sure. That would void your warranty for the Xbox, but not for the PS3. And I believe that was true on... Actually, it was the opposite on the PS3. It was easy to replace the hard drive on the PS3, but it would void your warranty. The Xbox 360 had a proprietary hard drive that was user accessible.
So cool, and there's some great pictures. If you head over to the show notes, you can see exactly how to tear apart the Xbox One here. This is pretty cool. You surprised they're still using a big old spinny disk? Or I guess it's a laptop drive. It's one of the 2.5-inch SATA 2 drives. But is that surprising? You think they would have used a solid state or something?
I was a little surprised, but not that surprised. It's much cheaper to use a hard disk for these components, and people are just not clamoring for that sort of out-of-the-box speed.
Yeah, maybe that'll be like the Xbox One Modern Warfare Edition. It'll have
it definitely will be an upgrade that comes pretty soon.
Yeah, and Renny brings up a good point in the chat room. Why don't they use SATA 3? That's kind of strange, isn't it?
They don't have SATA 3?
No, it's a SATA 2 drive.
I missed that detail.
So it says here it is a 500 gig, 5400 RPM, 8 megabyte cache, SATA 2, 3 gigabits per second hard drive.
Which one is that?
That's the Xbox One.
Uh-huh. Well, my question would be, if you replaced it, could you get SATA 3 or no?
No, I think the plug is the same, but I think the hardware would have to be able to know what it is. So I'm not entirely sure of that though.
Well, it's just one more example of why the PlayStation 4, Sony has provided better hardware out of the box than Microsoft has. And that's not surprising. Sony's a hardware company. Microsoft is a software.
True, they are coming at it from different angles, right?
Yeah.
So last thing on the PlayStation 4 and Xbox news here, they both have sold at least 1 million units within the first 24 hours of their release, and that's not entirely surprising.
Yeah, it'll be the long-term sales that really sell that, but we don't have those figures yet.
All right, well, let's move on to our next top news story of the week, and we've got a kind of interesting one here. There's a startup that is proposing to produce a new kind of credit card. So this is called the coin. And the idea is that you can you pair the coin with your phone, and your phone stores the credit cards. And there are a limited sub amount of credit cards that can be stored on the coin device. And the coin device basically is a little credit card, almost like an RFID card that has a little microprocessor in it. And this thing can store a few credit cards for you, and you can basically reprogram the mag strip on the device to act as if it were any of the credit cards that you have stored on that device.
Right. as a payment method, it's limited to just that magnetic strip. It can reprogram it, but it doesn't work with NFC or RFID chips. So it communicates. How does it communicate? With NFC or Bluetooth?
So it's Bluetooth to your phone, but the card and by itself has a limited number of cards stored onto it. So in other words, if you have, let's say you have 20 cards, which is ridiculous, but let's just say you had 20 cards for whatever reason. You could store, I don't remember what the number is here, but you could store a couple of them on the device, but then you could put, you could remove one from the device and put it back on your phone and move a credit card from your phone back up to the device, to the coin.
Sure, and I love this idea. Now, my only problem with it is that in my wallet, and I'd imagine a lot of other people's wallets, you'd want to use this card to replace all of the other cards in your wallet, basically replace the whole wallet, right? But it can basically only do credit cards. Anything that has RFID in your wallet, this card can't handle. And it's a first-generation product, so I would love to see the second generation have reprogrammable RFID as well as reprogrammable magnetic strips.
Yeah, and this is, it's not really a product that they've made yet. You know, it's still kind of in the prototype phase, and they're asking for funding, basically. And it's not on Kickstarter, so you don't get any protections whatsoever. You go to their website, and you just hand them money, and they may or may not deliver a card to you, depending on, you know, if they actually come to market with this device in the end. So I kind of like the idea of it, but in seeing what this is, I kind of had another idea. And I think it would be my preference, and maybe this exists and I'm unaware of it, but you don't literally want to put the credit card into this device, right? That's silly. Well, why don't we just have a card that acts as a proxy to many other cards, like something like Mint.com, but instead of aggregating your finances, you just charge specific stores to other specific cards and stuff like that. And I know this kind of thing already exists, but I haven't seen it in a way that makes sense for most consumers. But doesn't it seem silly? I mean, why are we pushing the credit card numbers around locally when we could just do it on the back end?
I see what you're saying. Okay, so you want a card that works a lot like this, but it has a different back end where there's only one identifier number that's attached to it, and then you process the back end to different accounts depending on how you want to do it.
Right. So I make a charge, and then the company that gave me the card actually looks at who the merchant is and then charges whatever card I specified up front with that particular charge, or have a default card or something like that. It just seems silly to swap around credit cards locally like this when you could just have the back end handle it. And then the other thing is that I'm not sure this is even technically not breaking the terms of service of credit cards. I'm not sure that this is even technically legal to do this.
Well, I think the credit card companies may have a few problems with it at first, but what you're talking about in terms of a business model, if we were to create what you're talking about, you'd have to create a new financial institution, and I think that is the major hurdle here. So
they have. It's not exactly what I was talking about, but there are some companies out there that offer proxy card services like this. Now, I haven't seen it with something as slick as like Mint.com or something like that, but they already kind of exist.
Okay, well, that's interesting, but you still need something like this to make what you're talking about happen. It needs to be smart on the front end as well as the back end.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think it's kind of strange that you have to have this device to do this kind of thing in the first place when it could all be handled on the back end.
I don't think it could, though.
Yeah, because you would just have a company that would send charges in either direction.
How does the company know?
Because you would set it up beforehand. So, like, all your bills from these merchants go to this credit card, and all of your gas from these merchants go to that credit card. And, you know, they know what merchants are what. You know, Mint is able to categorize these kind of things. So
right,
I'd imagine they could do the same thing.
you and I will have to have a brainstorming session to see if that's something that the market would want. But in the meantime, there is this prototype card that allows you to switch between credit cards.
Yeah, we'll start a company. We'll call it NIOC, which is coin backwards. And we would be sued immediately, I'm sure. But
by many, many people.
Yes. But anyway, with that kind of philosophical thing aside, I do still kind of like the idea of this. I'm just not sure it's ever going to make it to market is all.
I like that the founder of this startup, Kanishk Parashar, is basically building all of these prototypes by hand and actually using them as his personal credit cards.
Yeah, they've got a picture of one of the first prototypes, and it's basically a little Arduino mini board with a battery and something wrapped in copper wire. And he says he actually...
He's gotten it thinner than a millimeter just building them by hand. So once he gets his startup money, I will imagine he can do some amazing things with this, and we'll start to see some really cool technology come out of this. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not sure this particular incarnation will ever make it to market because I'm not sure they'll be allowed to. But even if they don't, I've got to imagine these guys are going to do something, even if it's not this particular product.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge step forward in terms of user technology that's widely accessible. It's cheap to produce, and it can reform the way that we pay for things, kind of like Google Wallet. But Google is taking a step backwards with Wallet because it used to just be you had to have an Android phone, and then it had to have NFC at first, and then they said, well, you don't need NFC, and then they came out with an iPhone app. And now Google Wallet has its own old-fashioned magnetic stripe credit card.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. You can use Google Wallet to actually make real-world purchases with this kind of credit card front. So that's kind of cool.
So as silly as it is, I think that Google is actually taking the step of becoming a financial institution by issuing these plastic cards. It doesn't really seem to fit Google's MO. I'm really tempted to get one of these Google Wallet cards.
Yeah, and the card is actually a MasterCard. So they must have worked something out with MasterCard where they could release their own branded MasterCard.
Yeah, and lots of companies have done that, of course.
Yep. But yeah, that's kind of neat. I wonder, you know, it's been a while since I've used Google Wallet, but I wonder what kind of features they could roll out like that. They might even be able to do the thing I was talking about earlier, where you can shuffle payments around the different cards and stuff.
You might be able to. Well, if I get one, I'll let you know.
Cool. All right, and with that, shall we turn on our afterburners?
I would be happy to. Wait, let me buckle my seatbelt. Would you like to start?
Sure. So the Moto G is now available in the United States. It's $179 for the 8-gig version and $199 for the 16-gig version. And that is an unlocked contract-free phone, people. The price of smartphones is really starting to drop.
Yeah, that's a pretty impressive price.
Yeah, and it's not the highest-end phone, but it's certainly passable. It's a 720p, 4.5-inch phone with a 5-megapixel camera. It's pretty nice.
So Google has also released a hands-free voice search app for Chrome. You just say, OK, Google, and this Chrome extension will allow you to use Google Now, just hands-free. You just talk to it. It's a clear extension of what they've been doing on Android phones for a while, especially with the Moto X and the Moto G. But now you can get it for any laptop or desktop.
Cool. So HBO has announced that, or I guess Google has announced on HBO's behalf, that HBO Go is now going to be working with the Chromecast. So in the same way that you can communicate with a Chromecast device and then have the Chromecast device communicate with Netflix on your behalf, you can do the same thing with HBO Go now. So HBO Go and Chromecast are a go.
Yeah, so it works from the Chrome browser and for the HBO Go app on Android and iOS. It's really impressive that they were able to roll this out so quickly, and people using PlayStation 3 who still don't have access to HBO Go are surprised that they were able to roll this out so quickly.
And we've got a Chromebook coming for the holidays. Speaking of Google, Acer has announced a touchscreen Chromebook, which is the C720P. It's going to be available in December for about $300.
A $300 touchscreen Chromebook with all the latest modern technology and an LED backlit display, 7 second boot time, 7.5 hours of battery, and a 32 gigabyte SSD. It's an impressive device for $300.
Yeah, it's better than Google's Pixel, which was famously $1,300. Ouch.
Now, AOL has decided after 15 years, well, they haven't owned it for that long, but Winamp has been around for 15 years, but its development has officially ceased. And so people who still use Winamp, some, I know many people who have been using Winamp for 15 years.
Yeah.
And it will no longer be supported. And it may be picked up in open source, but AOL has declined to release it to the open source community as of today.
There was some rumor that Microsoft was trying to buy it off of AOL. So I don't know. We'll see how that shakes out. So sadly, another closing we'll be talking about is Turntable FM. That's the site that would allow you to take your music and play DJ for a little while as other people watched in a virtual room and rate you and stuff like that. It was a pretty cool product. I must have used it for just a couple days before I left it alone. And the company is trying to pivot into a live streaming model. So more details on that later. We'll see how they do with that.
And Dropbox has released a major revamp for iOS 7. I've used this briefly, and it is great on the iPad. It's a huge improvement for the iPad. The iPhone is less of an improvement in my mind, but still an improvement. They've redesigned the whole user interface to mesh with the iOS 7 interface, but mostly it's the functionality that's really improved.
So the lawsuit between Google and the Authors Guild is finally over, and the verdict has been that Google is in the clear to be able to scan all of the orphaned works that aren't quite public domain but aren't claimed by any particular author, and they've just been kind of scanning these books in for a long time now. I think when we first started the podcast, this lawsuit was starting. So it's finally over, and the ruling is in the favor of Google, I assume, unless they appeal in some manner.
I have a feeling they will. Now, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has finalized their ruling allowing electronics use during all phases of flight, including takeoff and landing. And so this is nearing the final chapter of this saga in which many people have been severely inconvenienced by not using their electronic devices on airplanes. And the legal paperwork in United States airspace has finally been cleared to use your electronics in airplane mode, of course, whenever you are on an airplane.
Nice. I was waiting a long time for that to come down the pike, particularly for Kindles and the like.
Indeed, especially them, because they use less power than some watches, even when they're on.
Yeah, as long as you're not turning the page. So Microsoft has been a terror with the Windows Phone App Store at this point. Since we last podcasted, which was 2 weeks and a couple days ago at this point, Waze has released an app. Mint has had an app that is in beta for Windows Phone. Instagram for Windows Phone has been released, and Redbox Instant for Windows Phone has been released on a 60-day exclusive for Lumia devices. On the side there, they've also released the Xbox One Smart Class app and an Office Remote app, so you can use your Windows Phone as a PowerPoint remote or something like that. So pretty cool stuff. I think those are all the kind of platform-making apps that Windows Phone was missing in the first place. So it's definitely good to see some of those guys come around. And Now I can finally stop listening to people complaining about Instagram on Windows Phone. That's good.
Yeah, these are really great improvements. These were a couple of glaring holes in the Windows Phone platform, which has been out for a while now. Windows Phone 8 has been out for over a year, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely they're filling in the gaps, and for whatever reason, these past 2 weeks have been really big for that.
Right. So I think that's huge. I don't know about closing the gap by the end of next year, but this is a great sign for the whole platform of Windows Phone 8.
Yep. All right. Well, we can turn off the afterburners. You can undo your seatbelt. Sit back.
Okay. Let me have a sip of beer. All right. Let's continue.
All right. So into the end user stories we go, and I wanted to pretty quickly just mention that Flipboard is now available for Windows 8.1. So just like we were talking about with the Windows Phone apps there and the afterburners, this is the kind of platform-making app that needs to be in your store. And now for Windows, it is in fact in the store. So there's still a bunch of Windows 8 apps that are missing, but Flipboard is now not one of them.
Yeah, Flipboard was a really seminal app for the adoption of the iPad. It came out very quickly after
the
iPad App Store was launched, and it has been hugely influential in terms of app design and has developed a big following. So to see this on Windows 8.1 is really great, and it must have taken a lot of back-end work to get it ready for full Windows 8. But I'm glad to see it there. It's a good thing for sure.
Yeah, and I've really only gotten to sign into it and play with it. My first impressions are extremely positive. I really like just the kind of design of the app and the way it looks. As to how functional Flipboard is in the first place, I don't quite know yet. But it will be interesting to see what goes on with this. And again, this is an app you need to have. And it's good to see that the company that makes Flipboard is thinking about Windows 8 in the first place. So that's definitely a positive.
All right. So in our next story this week, we wanted to report that the forums of MacRumors.com, a very popular Apple News website, have been hacked. The password data, which was salted and hashed, was leaked for about 860,000 users.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring this up. They, you know, who cares about Mac Rumors forums, right? It's actually quite a few users, as it turns out. But it seems like something not of the magnitude that we would report, perhaps. But they basically realized that they had been hacked in some manner, and they're not quite sure how. So they're having people reset their passwords. They're being very cautious. And they're reporting that the passwords were indeed hashed and salted using an MD5 hash. So that is good to see. So for once, the PSA is actually kind of good news. So they did get hacked. I get it. And that's a bad thing. But they treated their passwords properly with the respect that their users deserve. And I think that is a wonderful sign for Mac Rumors. And if more companies just treated the data with respect like Mac Rumors did, we would be a whole lot better off in the end.
Yeah, I have tremendous respect for Mac Rumors. They are one of my favorite Apple News websites. We don't usually include their stuff on the show because we don't report many rumors on the show, but they're a fantastic media outlet, and I would have expected no less of them.
All right, shall we get into some more Windows news here?
If we must, Chris, if we must.
So we talked a little bit already about the Nokia Lumia 2520, but what's happened now is...
Now, that's the new tablet. It's the new 10-inch Surface RT tablet from Nokia.
Or not Surface RT, because that's the Microsoft one, but the only other Windows RT device out there other than the Surface RT.
Is that right? It's the only one?
That's the only one, yeah.
Wow.
So there's plenty of Windows 8 tablets, but it's the only other one that runs on ARM and thus is Windows RT. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to mention off the top of my head here that the device, you know, has gotten out to the reviewers, and all the reviews have been posted since we first talked about it on its launch day. And it seems to be kind of a device that is opposite the Surface in that it's got a few features that the Surface doesn't, and the Surface has a few features that this thing doesn't. And depending on the kind of person you are, you might want to take a look at this. So if you are, in fact, looking at Windows RT tablets like the Surface 2, you might also want to take a look at this thing. It's got LTE, and the Surface does not. It doesn't... apparently, the keyboard is not quite out yet, and that is coming shortly. And the thing doesn't include a kickstand, so depending on what kind of person you are, this might be a decent device for you. So we've got a link over to Mary Jo Foley's article in ZDNet there. And if you're interested, go have a deeper dive. So our last Windows story of the week here is, this is just crazy to me. Dell's releasing this 8-inch Windows tablet. And this thing is an 8-inch full Windows 8.1 tablet. Like we said, the Surface and the Nokia tablet are the only RT devices, but this is an actual 8-inch full Windows device with the Bay Trail Atom CPU inside of it. So it looked pretty impressive. It's going to be on sale for $230, which is just incredible. It's got a 1280 by 800 IPS display, which, albeit slightly low, it is an 8-inch device, so you can give it a little slack on that. And it's I cannot believe that you can get a full Windows device for that kind of price.
It is an insane price. Like that, it's a Windows 8 computer.
Yes.
That fits in your hand and costs $299.
Yeah, or $230 is the sale price as of
right. Oh, wow.
It's pretty wild. It's technically $229 for this device. I mean, it's just bonkers. I can't imagine. That has to be like a loss leader situation or something. I can't imagine that they would make any profit off of this, but it's pretty bonkers.
Yeah, the suggested retail price is $300 for the 32 gigabyte version, which is low enough. But at $229, that must be a loss leader. You're right about that.
Yeah, it's just stupid. There's no way that they're not losing money on that. But as consumers, we will take it, right?
Yeah, so that's pretty impressive. All right, so if you had the money to buy either one, you know, you could get the big Windows RT tablet, the Lumia 2520, or the little Dell Windows 8 tablet, the Venue 8 Pro. Which one did you think you would go for? You get to keep the extra money, too, the Dell.
That's the key. I think I'd get the larger one. But, you know, you can spend $230 and not feel too bad about it. So I think I would want the larger one, and I would get the 8-inch one and be disappointed.
Well, there's the difference between you and me, Chris. All right, so enough about these Windows hybrid tablets, because you had these two in there. I wanted to throw a story in here about Apple's regular laptops. That is the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro. Now, as we reported last month, the MacBook Pro was updated to the same modern Intel chipset that the MacBook Air has had since June. And it also got a price break. The MacBook Pro with Retina display, the 13-inch.
That is the Haswell, right?
Yeah. That now starts at $1,300, whereas the base model MacBook Air starts at $1,100. So Ars Technica has written a review for people who are on the line between these two computers. You know you need a new laptop. You know you're probably going to get an Apple laptop. These two are so close in terms of specs and price. Which one do you really want? And I think that Ars Technica has done a really great job of separating the differences here and explaining in plain terms why you would want one or the other one. And when it comes to features, they are basically equivalent in price. If you spec them out with the same features, you're basically getting the same value. But one's bigger and more powerful, and one is smaller and lighter and has a longer battery life. So there are a lot of fine details to consider, and if you really need to decide between the two, I think this is a great article to read, which is why I'm sharing it, along with my feelings of inadequacy because Chris had so many Windows 8 stories.
I'll take the smaller, lighter one, please.
Really? You wouldn't want to go for the Retina display? I mean, it's only a half pound lighter.
Nah, because the way I use a laptop, it's got to be portable.
You don't think 3.46 pounds is portable enough?
No, but the smaller I can tolerate, the better in a laptop. If I want to do something big, I remote into my desktop and, you know, use that.
What if you had to sell your desktop to get a new laptop?
See, now that would complicate things. Maybe I would rethink the larger one.
Okay. So, but that is an excellent point of why it's so important to figure out which of these laptops. If you know you're getting a Mac laptop, not everybody wants to go that way. But if you do, you probably know it. And so this is a great way to figure out the differences between the flagship models of each of these two lines, the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro, which are the only laptops available from Apple at this point.
Cool. So let's get into your green tech story of the week. But first, I would like to tell you that all lamps in the new apartment that I have moved into now have LED light bulbs.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Which kind of LED bulbs did you have?
So they were whatever was at IKEA when we were at a recent trip there. And they are the 10-watt.
Wait, you buried the lead here. IKEA has LED bulbs now?
Oh, all over the place in multiple varieties? Yes, yes, absolutely.
All right, well, that is my official top green tech story of the week. IKEA is selling LED bulbs. People, just go get some. You'll save energy.
So these are...
I had no idea.
These are 600 lumen, I think 60-watt equivalent, and they are 10 watts.
That's pretty impressive. And it's... IKEA puts a lot of thought into the products that they provide, most of them anyway, and so that sounds like a pretty good deal to me. It must be price equivalent to the industry standard Cree LED light bulbs.
Yeah, I forget exactly how much they cost. They weren't horrible, though. They were, if I remember, they were under $30 by a long
sure.
shot. That's how much the Crees cost, right? They're somewhere around $30?
No, they're cheaper than that.
They're cheaper than that? Okay, well, they were somewhere south of $30. I forget exactly what the price was. But
Okay, well, I will look into that.
They had, last thing on this, they had multiple levels of lumen and efficiencies. I think they had three levels of LED light bulbs.
And they listed the efficiencies on there?
Yes. So they listed the actual wattage, the wattage equivalency, and the lumens that they put out.
You know, some people make fun of IKEA, but I think that they are a very impressive company from a consumer standpoint and from an environmentability standpoint.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. I'm waiting to see if they put off too much heat sometimes underneath the lamp covers. So we'll see, because we got the most powerful ones.
All right, now my other green tech story.
Yeah, sorry to derail you.
is a new study from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which reaffirms something that we've talked about on this show before, and that is the possible negative effects of switching national energy grids to renewable energy are a tiny fraction, and this is a quote, a tiny fraction of the ultimate savings. So a grid powered by renewable energy is going to be far cheaper to operate and will, in the long term, be more stable and cheaper as time goes on. So the integrated costs of running the grid will always be cheaper as time goes on if you continue to switch toward renewable energy.
So it just takes some upfront investment, but in the long term you would actually save money, even with the transition of the infrastructure?
Yeah, that's right. And the
neat.
The upfront costs are dropping every month, every year.
Cool. And is this across all kinds of renewables? This is just renewables versus non-renewables?
yeah, this is looking at renewables versus non-renewables. And in the summary that I have from EcoGeek, they don't point out any particular technology which is better or worse than any other technology. This is looking at renewable energy sources on the whole as compared to non-renewable energy.
Cool. All right, well, let's get into our tip of the week. As usual, Mr. Marr, you have us covered. What you got for us?
Yeah, this is great. So I discovered this using OS X Mavericks this past month. If you've installed OS X Mavericks, you may have noticed that you have many more options for automatically updating your software. Now, this applies to anything that is built into your Mac or anything that you bought on the Mac App Store. Now, I, for a while, had set my automatic updates to run in the background without telling me. This became a problem when it all of a sudden ate up all my battery life.
During the podcast.
Yeah, and so then, well, I'm never on battery during the podcast, but these things can happen, and it could have been a problem during the podcast. I'm lucky it wasn't. It takes up a lot of system resources when your computer is updating its software automatically in the background, especially if there's a big update being pushed through. So just this past week, I had to turn it off, and I discovered a new feature in the manual updates. So if you open up the Mac App Store on your desktop, then you can select a drop-down box and choose to install automatic updates now, in an hour, sometime tonight, which any new Mac laptop can do even if you close the computer, or you can ask for a reminder the next day. So it's a great way to regulate your system updates, make sure that they happen when you're not going to be inconvenienced by them, because believe me, I was inconvenienced when they happened automatically.
Yeah, that's
pretty
cool.
So this is a really cool new feature. If you thought that you had to choose between forcing the updates yourself right away or having the updates happen automatically, which is the case with iOS right now, you can now choose to have the updates happen whenever is best for you.
Yeah, and there's something, I can't quite put my thumb on it, but there's something very Apple about a menu item that says, try tonight. If Microsoft made that same menu, it would say, try at 12 a.m.
Yeah, try 12, 17, 13 at 5 a.m.
But that's subtly a very nice feature. Cool.
Yeah, I think it's nice. It's intuitive. All you have to do is hold the update button in the update section of the Mac App Store and just hold it down until that menu pops up. It was a great new thing that I found. I was really excited about it, and I wanted to share it. Now, after that, we have our app pick of the week, and that is a Windows 8 app pick, which I've chosen for you. And Chris, you said you hadn't even heard about this yet.
No, I had no idea. It looks neat. I'm going to try it after we get off the air here.
Yeah. All right. This is a Windows 8 app called ObliTile. And what it allows you to do is create custom tiles in almost any method that you, or any design that you can imagine, for your Windows 8 modern UI application launcher, the new Windows 8 start screen. You can create tiles that fit the Windows 8 scheme of having a simple monochrome icon, or you can do a full color, full tile background if you like. Now, this has been out for a while, but I just found out about it because a good friend of mine had just gotten a new Windows 8 computer and was really excited. This changed his whole impression of the new Windows 8 start screen, having the ability to create custom tiles that he could also resize to his specifications.
Cool. So, you know, it's not something I've really had a need to do, because for the most part, other than a couple exceptions, I've just kind of booted into the desktop mode and I use the keyboard to search for things. But I definitely could see if you wanted a better way to get at some of the stuff that you wanted to get in the Metro interface, that this would be a pretty big win for you. And it sounds like for your friend it was.
Well, I was very excited to hear about it, and I was happy to talk to him about it for a while. And I thought I just had to share it on the End User this week. It's a great app, and the fact that you hadn't heard of it, Chris, means that it's just simply not getting the publicity that it ought to.
It means you are on top of your game, sir.
It means I was paying attention. That's what it is.
Yes. All right, well, we are going to go without a kicker this week, since we've missed a couple weeks. Actually, we're doing pretty good on time, so I think we went through that pretty well. So, Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you in some way, reaching out across the internet, how would they do this?
Emails are the traditional form to reach out across the internet. You can find me at taylormar.com. You can find me at taylor@thedigitalmediazone.com. You can find me on Google+. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. I am at taylorphone.
And you can always use an Ethernet poltergeist to reach Taylor as well. That's one of my favorite methods.
I'm Wi-Fi only, man. I don't know how you plan on doing that. But please, please do not Ethernet poltergeist me.
Yeah, you could. Or there must be a 802.11n poltergeist as well. It's of the same family of program.
Well, that sounds scary. But go ahead and do that one.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. All right, and I live on Twitter, so if you wanted to contact me in some way with some feedback about the show or whatever, I am at Chris Hale Barnes, so please feel free to do so. All right, Taylor, what do you say? Let's get out of here.
If you say so, Chris. I'm having a great time.
So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a handful of other podcasts that keep a better schedule than we do. Have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 for all of the Xbox bonanza that has been happening the past couple weeks. Have a listen to Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and the latest of Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got a collective email, theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can use our Twitter. We are at The End User. Join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Meyer.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
You really gonna Wi-Fi poltergeist me?